Speakers, welcome to our conference call of February the 5th, 2015. I'm David Rothberg, and with me is Al Friedberg. Good morning, Al.
Good morning, David.
Before we start, just a little bit of housekeeping as we do every quarter. A reminder that if anyone has questions, they can email those questions to erott@niagaracapital.ca, and Eddie will pass those questions on to me. Typically, our format is that I'll act as a bit of an interlocutor and ask Al some questions that are put to me in person. And if there are questions that you want to ask in addition to those, please feel free to do so by sending them to Eddie. After we try and hold the conference call to about 45 minutes to give everybody a chance to get back to work early this morning or early-ish this morning. And after the conference call, we'll post a podcast of the calls both on the Friedberg website and on the Niagara website. Okay, with no further ado, let's begin. Al, why don't we start today by you're giving us an overview of where we are in the fund.
Okay. The fund for the year. You mean for the year?
Well, where we're positioned now.
Where we're positioned. Okay. Well, the fund has not changed a great deal. Just here and there, we have made some small little changes, but basically the themes remain the same. On the long side, we are long home builders, and we also have a small position in a fair position in airlines, U.S. airlines, and those are the main position on the long side. On the short side, we are short a number of different groups of stocks. For instance, we are short a little bit of India still. We are short a little bit of Korea. We had a bunch of puts at one time, but we liquidated those puts. So let me put it this way: we are now, and by the way, on the long side, we also long Japan, the Nikkei. So we are now positioned about 35% net long. Our portfolio is 35% net long. Then we have still a substantial position in bonds, German bonds. Now we added a little bit of U.S. treasuries too. We are long gold, and that remains still around 35 to 40%. And we are short crude oil. That remains around 20 to 25% of the portfolio. And that's basically the post-for. So there's been very small changes here and there, but the main things remain the same.
You know, what's conspicuously absent are trades that relate directly to the issue that I think is more discussed than any other, or certainly if we're to gauge by the number of questions that have been put to us, and that, of course, concerns Greece. Perhaps you would give us a take on where you think, how you think the Greek drama will play itself out, and how you've positioned yourself either by taking a position or by not taking a position as a result.
Okay, we still hold, by the way, positions, and I didn't mention them because they're not. I just didn't mention they're not trading positions, but we still have a moderate position, a little bit more than moderate, say a moderate to heavy position in CDS. We're long protection on Brazil, on Spain, on Portugal a little bit, and Venezuela still. So for us, and a small amount also of Italy. So for us, a unraveling of the euro situation eventually should benefit. We should benefit from it. We have no position in Greece. We think Greece is a relatively minor issue at the moment. It depends how it's handled. I'd say 50% chance that Greece will be forced to exit. That may be something that the main creditors would want to do to signal the rest of the European peripherals to let's say to behave. I don't think that there is much that one can do about Greece, but we have done something interesting in that we have gone short the Bulgarian currency, who is a neighbor of Greece, just in case something happens in Greece and it may affect Bulgaria. It's almost a no cost proposition, so it pays for us to do it. But other than that, Greece is not a question of numbers, really, or of dead numbers. It may seem that they're trying to get out of their very heavy debt. Truth is, their debt is very heavy, and there's been a lot of mistakes along the way made by the creditors, and that should never have been done. But the main issue here is an issue of the wish of the new socialist government to do something to get rid of a lot of the reforms. And we're not now speaking so much about macro numbers and bringing down the fiscal costs, but it's about reform. For example, a major pillar of the reform was privatizations. Greece never really complied with that. They were supposed to do about $50 billion worth of privatizations. They did so far maybe $4 or $5 billion. And now they are canceling all pending privatizations. So this is the first move of a socialist government. They are raising minimum wages, something that went against the original agreements. They're doing a number of things already, and they've already done a number of things that just show the direction of where this government wants to go. But many of the reforms that were imposed on them by creditors were actually for the benefit of Greece in the long run. It was a way to reduce the size of the state that was very inefficient, very, very inefficient, a bloated state, and make it and something. This is something that the Greeks never really did. So, other than just imposing a lot of pain on the population by increasing taxes, Greece did not do anything at all about reform, true reform. And so, the lenders, the creditors, held the debt over their heads as a way of imposing these reforms, but now they want to squirrel out of it and be able to do what they want to do with respect to social programs. So my thinking is that it's a 50-50 proposition, but and the idea of extend and pretend is something that has been going on in Europe for a long time, but if it is extended and pretended, I think Greece will become even more inefficient, and very little will be done in the way of productivity and growth. So other than that, it doesn't have much of an incidence in the rest of Europe, except if the creditors take a hard stance. If they do, I think that the Europeans may have bought another 6 months of quiet before the next crisis develops, maybe in Spain, along the same lines. This whole idea that you can nurse these economies back, which in essence went out of control because of the inflow of money that the very euro system, when the euro system was put in place, the inflow of money that went into them and the inflation of their cost was such that it got them into trouble. The very idea that you can fix it by lending them more money is faulty, and we are seeing now that this is the result, and all of the other countries. All they have done in the past 5 years is increase debt. If you look at the debt to GDP ratios in all of them, they have increased substantially. So the prescription itself is not workable. And I think that in the end, the euro as we know it today will unravel.
How are you positioned? This is not something that you can position yourself for now. But what's
How would you play that? Correct. It's not easy to do that. As I say, one of the ways we've done it now is we did this earlier and we've done it again. Now it's cheaper to do it. You can buy protection. You can buy protection on debt as a way to benefit from that or as a way to play that. But there is a cost, and so you can do that in large amounts because it's just timing is a big issue.
The credit default swap market has changed a lot from 2007, has it not?
Markets have changed a lot. Markets have become probably more vulnerable than they were in 2007. I mean, we today there was a report showing in the financial press that the debt has increased around the world. It is much higher than it was in 2007. So we are more vulnerable today than we were then, and asset prices have increased substantially since then, so we are more vulnerable.
But what I'm saying is that the credit, you might not have heard me, I was saying the credit default swaps, which were the way that you played
default
in 2007, have become, they're cheaper, but they're harder to trade now. The spreads are wider. There are fewer dealers who are operating in that market
today.
That's
right. That's correct. They're cheaper, but they're harder to trade. And there have been changes made to the way they get settled, and that's complicated. And now you're introducing different series of credit default swaps. So it is a technical problem. So it is becoming more difficult. But then we have other ways of playing that. I believe that sovereign debt of the highest quality, right now probably the highest quality of all is the German bonds, will continue to do well. It will probably end up, the 10-year bond will probably end up in a negative with negative yields. The 5-year already does have negative yields, and probably U.S. Treasuries will also end up with not negative yields but maybe very low yields. So that this is a way that you can play this coming problem in credit. But the other way is that central banks have pushed. Central banks have pushed, and this is a very important theme. Central banks have pushed investors into equities by removing a very substantial amount of sovereign debt from the market. They have literally pushed the entire spectrum of investors into equities, and so there's very little choice but to be invested in some sectors, especially those sectors that we think have a lot of potential. And so that's in a way another way of playing this very, very complicated and strange situation.
It gives us an opportunity to beat the old drum of home builders. We've talked about it virtually every quarterly call now, dating back to 2009. I think you've had the position that long. Where are you at with the trade now?
Still the same. We like them. I think that they've been doing better, actually, for the past few months, have outperformed the index, the S&P. They're firming. We're getting a lot of interesting macro numbers that support our view. For instance, the household formation. We've had the largest increase in household formation in many, many years, maybe 20 years. 2 million household formations, that's a lot. And that tells us that they're going to be buying or renting homes. Now, vacancy rates and rentals are down to 7%. That's one of the tightest vacancy rates we've ever had. So one way or the other, you're going to need to produce or create shelter. You produce housing. So the numbers are good. Mortgage rates continue to drop, and we're starting to see now an increase in mortgage applications for new homes. So all the elements are there for what I think will be eventually a boom in housing in home builders.
Okay. The other seismic event that's happened since we spoke last 3 months ago has been the oil market. It's a reminder to the world of just how significant oil is to us all. It's happened suddenly. Can you tell us, first of all, how you positioned yourself in oil? You've been a bear for many, many years, and where you are with it now, what you expect will happen with oil?
Yeah, the fall in oil prices was an inevitability. The problem was the question was timing, and the U.S. producers, the frackers, what we call, are the ones who eventually pushed the market over. Their production was increasing. Once they got over a certain level, which I think that the production increased something like 4.5 million barrels a day from 5 years ago, and that increase finally tilted the market, or what it did, more than that, it forced the big OPEC producers, like the Gulf producers, to take note and to realize that if they maintain prices where they were, they would be priced out of the market, totally priced out of the market. And so the decision made by the Gulf producers at that point was, no, they will go for market share. They want to sell the amount of oil that they can produce, basically. For the Saudis, it's approximately 10 million barrels a day, and they will maintain, will try to maintain the market share, which is the correct position to take. And I think that they will, at least on the surface, what we can read from what they say, they will maintain this policy until such time as they can displace other producers. And they're starting to make a lot of other producers very uncomfortable, and we'll talk about that in a minute. And B, until demand rises, given the lower prices. So, who is going to cut production? Well, this is complicated, because normally when the price of a commodity goes down, in a market like this, you have producers increasing production to make up for the fall in prices. So we've seen that happen now in Iraq. We have seen this happen in Russia. We've seen this happen in a number of countries who are trying to up production in order to make up for the drop in prices. And so it's counterproductive in a way, right, what's happening. Secondly, the second complication is that countries normally do not lose competitiveness, because a country can always devalue and so always stay ahead or be as competitive as it was earlier, more or less. So Russia, for example, allowed the ruble to come down, which allows their cost to go down, which allows their revenues to increase substantially in local currency. And so Russia is not likely to be put out of business, and they will continue to produce. So will Venezuela, any country that can engineer a devaluation and therefore lower its costs and increase its revenues. The ones that are affected the most will be private companies. The drillers in the United States, the shale oil producers, they're affected. At some point, it will become not profitable for them to produce anymore. A lot of numbers are being bandied around. I don't know enough of the economics of that business, and it's very, very different in different areas, the shale areas. But somewhere between, say, $50 or $60 and $30, most of these producers will be losing money. Now, let's remember one thing. They're probably losing money already, but they're covering the variable cost. You know, they're losing money because they invest a lot of money in drills and so on, in royalty payments. But they are covering costs, and as long as they're covering costs, they will continue to produce. And so that means that we're not going to see a significant decrease in fracking for some time. And it may require the price of oil to go down to maybe, I don't know, $30 or $25, some level at which it will become unbearable, and they may not even be able to cover variable cost. However, the interesting thing is that these guys are very, very inventive, they're very creative, and they're very enterprising. And so they may be put out of business temporarily, but if the price were to jump back to $60, I think you're going to see them back there. And so what's happening is that this has changed the game. This means now that there is a ceiling on the rebound. We should not expect anything like what happened in 2009, where the market went down to, I don't know, $30 or $40, and then turned around and went all the way back to $120. This is not the same thing. What we have here is a new factor, and this factor is going to put a ceiling. As soon as the price goes back to a level that makes sense for these frackers to go back into the market, they will, and so they will put a lid on the market. So I'd say that on the upside, short of a conflict in the Middle East, a serious conflict in the Middle East, on the upside, you won't see anything above $60. And we may be playing in a range of 25 to 60 for a long time to come.
And you are short in the fund.
We're still short. Exactly. We're still short the back months. We were always short the back months, always afraid that some conflict in the Middle East may ignite a sharp rally in the nearby positions. So the effect would be mostly felt in the front months. So we have short in the December 16, December 17 positions. They have not gone down, of course, as much, because what's happening is that the spot month is the one that has taken the most of the drop. As oil has become plentiful, we now have moved into a very wide contango, something like $10 for a year.
For those investors who don't know what that means, it means that the deferred contracts trade at a premium to the cash contracts.
Correct. So as the cash price went down, the forwards went down less fast, right? Less fast, and then moved from a discount at one point, they were at a discount 2 years ago, to a premium, and so that took away a lot of your profit if you were short. However, you are earning that profit every month because you are earning that carry, that maybe 80 cents a month carry, and so just being short back months is still profitable, and it will be profitable. And we think that, by the way, that we think that as long as the back months, like December 16, trade above $55 or some number like that, and by the way, it's trading at $65. So as long as it trades about $55, $60, it is profitable for even producers in the U.S. to hedge their output and therefore prolong the period of time in which they will continue to produce. Right? They are protected by selling oil at $64 or $60 or $62 or $65. So the futures markets are the forward and futures market are providing hedge to producers, and it's not easy to displace them. It's not going to be easy to displace them.
The response of Russia and Iraq to what Saudi Arabia has done is, in a way, a microcosm of the deflationary cycle. Increasing production to make up for declining prices, which, of course, causes prices to decline further. It was precisely that Draghi was trying to contest with the ECB's decision 2 weeks ago. Where do you think the economic jury is with regards to the big question of, is it inflation, is it deflation that we're facing? And how does the response of gold over the past couple of months either reflect that kind of discussion, or does it really reflect upon it at all? Is it dealing with other issues altogether?
Okay. Let me take it in two parts. The first part is what central banks have done, what's called quantitative easing, this enormous purchases of treasuries that they've been engaged in over the past 4 years, and that is the U.S. and Japan and England and now the ECB. In the past, and I'm talking about in the past 30, 40, 50, 60 years, in the past, The way you can get money supply to increase was for the central bank to buy treasuries, allow those treasuries to allow those purchases to increase reserves, bank reserves, and with additional bank reserves, the banks would be able to lend money and therefore increase money. So that was the normal course of events. That was the prescription given normally if you wanted to increase money. That's what would happen. This was the fear 4 or 5 years ago when QE was undertaken on a massive scale, this was the fear that this would happen, that all of those billions, hundreds of billions and trillions of dollars would find their way into excess reserves, and therefore banks would be able to have a lot of money to lend. It hasn't happened yet. It hasn't happened, and I add yet. And the reason it hasn't happened, there's a number of reasons why it didn't happen, but that probably what is happened is that the first of all, the intermediaries in this are the banks, the commercial banks. The commercial banks have been under very heavy monitoring by authorities, and their ratio, their debt, their assets to capital ratios have been tightened so that they need to have more capital in order to have more assets outstanding. They have been increased a number of times. They also have been very closely regulated in terms of what they can lend and how they can lend it. And so what we're finding out is that banks have not been a good intermediary in this case for all that money that's sitting. All the money is sitting in excess reserves, and it's trillions of dollars sitting in excess reserves, and the banks are not taking advantage of it. Well, they're not taking advantage of it because they may not be able to take advantage of it, because they may need too much capital to do that, and because capital ratios have increased substantially in the past few years. So that's one problem. Another problem is that for now, it's a merry-go-round. This QE reduces banks' holdings of bonds or institutional holdings of bonds, and they turn around and instead of leaving the money or lending the money to the private sector, let's say, they end up buying more securities. And so there's like a bit of a circle, and we have created sort of an artificial circle in which all the money is going into more investments. And that's why we see security prices going up. That's why we see bonds going up and yields going down, is because it's staying in a circle, staying in a bit of I almost would call it a vicious circle, because it's an investment circle. It's a bubble circle. And so it hasn't yet spilled over. Nevertheless, having said that, those balances exist. Those excess reserves exist. At some point, the banks will begin to use them, especially the better capitalized banks. In the U.S., the very large five banks or six banks represent a very high proportion of total assets and deposits. But the other part, smaller banks, medium-sized banks, can increase their lending easier, and they are increasing. And we talked about it just earlier that they are increasing mortgage lending, and that will be another channel by which excess reserves will express themselves. And so when that happens, you will see money supply increasing. That money supply increases is what generates inflation. So if you look at what's happened in the last 5 years, you will see that money supply in none of these places, not in Japan, it's only been growing around 2.5% to 3.5% per annum. None in the U.S. has been growing at 6% to 7% per annum. These are very normal, very, very behaved rates of increases, okay? Not in Europe, where actually money supply for a number of years was actually negative, and now it's barely positive. And in the UK, it's negative still. So money supply has not behaved in an inflationary fashion. We have not had increases in money supply to validate inflation. If anything, countries that have not had an increase in money supply have experienced deflation. And the U.S., which has had sufficient money supply expansion, not excessive, has experienced some growth and some inflation, but moderate amounts, moderate levels of each. So what will happen as a consequence of what we have done, what central banks have done in the past few years, is that money will find its way eventually into more loans and will find its way into more deposits. And as we increase the amount of deposits, we will increase increase money supply. And as we increase money supply, we'll see at some point an increase in inflation and maybe at some point an uncontrollable increase in inflation. It's going to be very hard to control that. For the banks, for the central banks to control it would mean for them to raise rates very, very quickly. We're not there yet. I don't think we need to speak about it yet. We may be months away, we may be a year away, we may be 2 years away, I don't know. But the money is there, the money's available, it's like the fuel is there, and it will happen. So we shouldn't be thinking about deflation. Deflation is not something that we need to think about because, number one, most of the quote-unquote deflation that we're experiencing now is a result of the drop in raw material prices, like oil, like base metals, like wheat and soybeans and corn. But this drop is a one-time drop. This will reverberate through the consumer price index for some months, and after the effect is passed, that's it. The downward pressure is over. The downward move is over. So from that point on, inflation will take its course, and you know, economists speak about core inflation, and the core inflation will not be going into negative. So that's one reason why we shouldn't be thinking about deflation. It's a temporary factor. It is simply the drop in commodity prices, which has to do with economic growth and has to do with the fact that the world is not growing fast enough, and the fact that China is slowing its greater growth, and Europe is just growing very little, and so we have less demand for a lot of these products. We also have had nice increases in production because of high prices. So this combination has created a weak commodity sector. This weak commodity sector has had an impact on prices, and so we are seeing that quote-unquote deflation. As I say, in a few months, that effect will be basically washed out. We'll have seen most of the effect in CPI by the end of the year. And from that point on, you will not have the benefit of that drop in commodity prices. Secondly, you will have increases in money supply. They're inevitable. They will come. And when they come, they will begin to speed up activity, but more importantly, it will speed up prices. So now that brings me back to gold, and gold has two major catalysts. One of them is the debt situation around the world, and as I said before, it's getting worse, not better. Today's headlines, I think, in the Financial Times of London, debt mountains spark fears of another crisis. Well, yes, we have gone up way over the 2007 level in debts, and that means inevitably more defaults, a larger amount of defaults coming. And that is a catalyst for wanting to own gold. That's number one. And number two, as we get inflation, as we get money supply to increase and we start getting a little bit more inflation, gold will do well. That's another catalyst for gold. So we have now two elements that are going to be supporting higher gold prices. We need those who hold gold will need to be a little patient until that happens. But economic events happen a lot faster often than we think. And sometimes they take much longer to happen. Sometimes they happen suddenly. The collapse in the price of oil happened suddenly. The change in the rate of inflation and problems with debt can happen very quickly, and that can be a spark for gold prices to jump very quickly.
Well, that's right, Jim. You're rarely sent an invitation to the party. It's always begun before you're there. I'm happy to tell you that I found Bill's question, and it is this. He quotes another friend, David Rosenberg. He says that David Rosenberg thinks that the government securities bought by central banks in the QE operations will never be sold. So Bill's asking you, suppose that David's correct. Are the fundamentals of, say, Japan actually improving as QE reduces the holdings of government debt held by everyone else? And in places where there are negative interest rates, do you think that there will actually be a move to holding cash in serious amounts, that people will not put their money in securities at all, not either debt or equity securities, but hold it basically under their mattresses, proverbially?
That's a very good point, and I believe, yes, I believe that those bonds will not come back into the market. I believe that the bonds that the Bank of Japan bought will not come back into the market. In effect, there will be something like a defeasance. They will tear up, in a way, the debt. And this is one of the reasons why we are bullish in Japan, because, we, you know, over the years, many, many investors have said, look at the debt-to-GDP ratio in Japan. It's enormous. They're going to have to default. The answer is no, they won't default, because the government itself will be buying those debts by printing money. So right now, if you adjust by agencies and central bank holdings, I think that Japan's debt-to-GDP ratio may be under 100% instead of the 250 that everybody's talking about. And the U.S. is the same thing. All those bonds that they bought will not come back into, will not likely come back into the market. So what we have done is we have reduced significantly debt by having done that. We have reduced that expense, of course, of printing money, and that money, as I said before, that money will eventually create inflation. But we have reduced the debt problem, at least at the Treasury side, at the fiscal side. We have reduced it by having central banks buy back debt. So yes, I think David is right, Bill is right. Those bonds won't come back. And by the way, that's one of the reasons, as I said before, that's driving yields down. We have reduced the amount of debt, and we have a lot of institutions. We have a lot of pension funds. We have a lot of investors, savers for the next generation that have now a smaller menu of AAA or AA quality bonds to buy, because they have been taken away, withdrawn from the market. And that's the reason why yields continue to drop. Now, having said that, I think that the private sector will make sure to increase debt, and that's what they're doing. And so it will take up, at some point, it will take up this vacuum, but it will be at a lesser quality level, a lesser credit quality level. Will people hold cash instead of, well, yes. I mean, if institutions cannot hold cash, so it's going to be difficult for them, but what they do is they hold deposits, which in many countries is negative rates, right? In Switzerland, in Finland, and so on, you can hold deposits. In Denmark, you can hold deposits and earn negative rates, meaning you pay the government for you lending them money. Will individuals hold cash? Maybe individuals will want to hold cash instead of putting money in money market funds. I mean, if they see negative rates, they might as well hold cash, and that's possible. What the implications of that are, I'm not sure, but it does look like the distortions are going to get worse from this type of QE operations that were never undertaken in the past. This is something that in history has never been done. This money out of thin air.
If you expect that inflation will recover, so to speak, then you have to expect that yields will at least try to keep pace, and you'll then have some competition for equity securities and for cash. You can't expect declining yields in the face of rising inflation, surely.
Right, but you can have a repression of rates. For instance, say that the inflation moves up from 1.5% or 2% to 4%. It would imply that under normal conditions, those 5-year securities would be trading above 4%, right, to make up for it, to make up for this inflation rate. But if a central bank is still in the market controlling Fed funds at zero rates or 0.25% or 0.5%, that represses the whole spectrum of the whole term structure of rates. And so what happens is that you may have those 5-year bonds trading at 3% or 2.5%. It's very hard to know because the market really trades off very short-term rates. You carry those securities. You're a dealer, you carry those securities. You're an investor, you carry those securities. You carry them at very low rates, you're making money. If you carry them at 0.25% a year and you're investing at 3%, you're making money. So it's not a free market in rates. You know, in essence, once we have these activist central banks, we no longer have a free market in rates. So yes, inflation comes in, you start getting a higher rate of inflation, but you can have also financial repression, where rates, long-term rates, stay below the rate of inflation for a long time. It can happen.
So savers are penalized.
Yeah, savers are being penalized today, and they will continue to be penalized. Yes, it's government is taking money away from savers. Correct.
Al, we've put to you all the questions that have been sent to you, save one, and it relates to currencies. There's an investor who'd like you to comment on the move that the Swiss Central Bank made last week, or 2 weeks ago, rather.
By the way, we happen to have made some money in that. We had a small position that were long Swiss francs, but I couldn't understand why anybody was short the Swiss franc. It didn't make sense to me, because if you looked at the inflows, the Central Bank of Switzerland was to maintain that fixed rate with the euro, 120, they absorbed a lot of euros, and they kept absorbing euros. And so you know that at some point they will have to do something about that link. It's true. It's a lot easier to maintain a fixed rate when you are a buyer of the foreign currency, not a seller. When you're a seller of the foreign currency, your reserves can be exhausted. You know, we're finding that Russia is actually losing reserves rapidly, and so at some point they may not be able to intervene in the market. But when you're a buyer of foreign currency, you can do that for a long time. But eventually, you know that if that continues, they will have to stop. So for us, it was just a simple decision. Instead of buying euros at that point to hedge our Bulgarian, we bought Swiss at that time to hedge our Bulgarian currency. And we made money on that transaction. I think that it was a logical thing. What they did was absolutely logical.
Good. Well, I'll close with that, Al, and thank you very much for your time. It's nearly 10:30, and I think it's been a good discussion. Wish you luck for the coming quarter. Remind investors that this call will be presented in the form of podcasts on the Niagara Capital site and on the Friedberg Mercantile Group site. And with that, we'll close.